Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. It lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You've probably heard of alt-right media sites and programs like Breitbart and InfoWars, but there's also a growing alt-left media world. Since President Trump's election, liberal conspiracy theories have gained steam, and so have alternative left-wing blogs, Twitter personalities, and podcasts. Can they have as much influence on our politics as right-wing media? This hour, On Point, the alternative left media landscape. You can join us on air or online. Are you familiar with the alt-left media scene? Do you see unfounded liberal theories popping up on your social media pages? What do you make of them? Does it make it even harder to figure out what's real and what's not? Are there sites you don't trust? Sites you do? Sites you only read for a laugh? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is McKay Coppins, staff writer for The Atlantic. He covered Mitt Romney's presidential campaign for BuzzFeed News and wrote the 2015 book, The Wilderness, deep inside the Republican Party's combative, contentious, chaotic quest to take back the White House. His recent piece for The Atlantic is How the Left Lost Its Mind, and details the alternative left media landscape. You can link to that article on our website, onpointradio.org. McKay, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the Obama election was a spur to the explosive growth of right-wing information ecosystems. Was the election of Donald Trump the same kind of catalyst?
Well, yeah, I think that that's kind of the working theory for the piece that I wrote. And I don't think the question has been answered yet, but it's certainly one that needs to be explored. Like you said, when Obama took power, it was really a catalyst for this kind of explosive growth of a right-wing media ecosystem that we're not just talking about Fox News. We're talking about, you know, dozens, scores of blogs and websites that started off on the fringes, but while kind of no one was paying close attention, they slowly and gradually took over the Republican Party, or at least a large swath of it. I think Donald Trump, who's now obviously the president, began by kind of conquering this right-wing fringe back in 2011 when he started banging the birther drum, talking about this conspiracy theory about Barack Obama. So now the question is, could the same thing happen to the left? And I think, you know, it's a question that is met with a lot of derision from liberals, and understandably so, given all that's happening in our politics. But at the same time, you know, if you're paying close attention to this stuff as I am, you can see that the Trump era has really given rise to this kind of vast alternative liberal media infrastructure. And it includes, partisan click farms and podcasts and very popular Facebook pages that really command an audience in the millions. And some of these people increasingly seem to be turning away from credible mainstream news organizations and toward these liberal news outlets that give them validation and catharsis and kind of confirm all of their worst fears and suspicions about Donald Trump and the Republican Party.
As you were preparing to write your story and consuming a lot of this stuff, did you find that it's not really a binary thing, a true and untrue, a fact or no fact, but something that plots along a continuum from plausible and well-researched to, frankly, freaky?
Yes, absolutely. And that's an important point. I mean, a good example of this is these Facebook pages. Some of them are called Occupy Democrats, the other 98% addicting info. If you get a lot of your news from Facebook, you might see some of this stuff pumped into your newsfeed. BuzzFeed, where I used to work, they did a study during the 2016 election, an analysis of those three Facebook pages, which taken together have millions of followers. and found that in the frenzied final weeks of the election, about 20% of the stories that were posted by those Facebook pages, those liberal pages, were either mostly or partly false. And so that means that, you know, 80% of the stuff that they posted was either just kind of ideological content or straightforward news with a liberal bent, but 20%, one out of five stories was either partly or mostly false. And I think that this is a source of confusion for a lot of news consumers because they'll say, well, look, I follow these websites, I follow these Twitter personalities, whatever, these Facebook pages. And a lot of the stuff I see is just linked straight from the New York Times or the Washington Post or CNN. And that's true. But I think that what often happens is these liberal websites that have a clear agenda and are trying to get clicks will sometimes aggregate or pass along credible news stories that are damaging to Republicans. But they don't have the same journalistic standard that a lot of us operate with. So instead, while they'll pass along a CNN story, they'll also pass along a story from a liberal blog like the Palmer Report, which is kind of known for advancing conspiracy theories without credible sourcing. So you really have to be careful with this stuff.
You know, in the old media world, people who were trying to understand ratings and trying to understand old media virality used to try to count, when I worked for magazines, pass along readership, that somebody would buy the magazine and maybe another three people would read it. And it was really, really hard to quantify. But in the new media landscape, that kind of thing, click through and pass along and cutting and pasting, you can count it. But also it changes because of who it is who's sending it along to you. Is that part of the phenomenon, that if you open up your Twitter feed or your Facebook stream, you'll see things passed along from people you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the ways that these Facebook pages especially get so popular so fast and amass millions of followers is that when you log on to Facebook and you see somebody share this story, it's not just, you know, a story in Newsweek magazine or Time magazine or whatever. It's a story being vouched for and promoted by a friend or family member, somebody you presumably trust and like, right? And so you're more likely to take it seriously, to trust it, to take it at face value. This is one of the reasons that I think it's so important, and I'm constantly banging this drum. But before you post something on social media, before you share a story on social media, it's so important to just take the extra 30 seconds to double check, see if it's been reported by a credible news outlet, see if it's been if it's sourced to something real as opposed to a blog you've never heard of or a Twitter personality whose credibility you don't know about. Because once you put it on your Facebook page, there's a very good likelihood that everyone from your neighbors to your friends to people at your church to old high school friends are going to say, well, I know so-and-so, and he's a pretty smart guy, so I guess I can take that seriously. Another part of this, though, I will say, is that it's not just friends who are kind of vouching for these stories that give them credibility. There's also a class, and I write about this in the Atlantic piece, of what I call VIP validators, where they're increasingly in the Trump era, we've seen that there are people who are not necessarily very sophisticated or savvy about politics or media. They don't come from that world. But they have a lot of prominence and credibility in other fields, whether it's academia or history or law or literature. So famous authors or world-renowned constitutional scholars who are politically liberal and will see a story in a kind of left-wing blog, and they'll post it to their Twitter account kind of saying, oh, this is interesting if it's true. And while, you know, they're not necessarily saying it is true, I know it's true, a lot of people will see it and they'll say, oh, well, that person is very prominent and they wouldn't share a story that's fake, so I'm going to retweet it. This is another way that this kind of misinformation and conspiracy theory stuff tends to spread.
Three little words. If it's true. So much is gained and lost in those three little words. One of the real stars created by this new phenomenon that you describe is a woman named Louise Mensch. In March, the BBC's Andrew Neil spoke to Mensch, a former member of the British Parliament. She's amassed a large Twitter following by spreading stories relating to Russia and the U.S. election, many of them unfounded. Here, Neil questions Mensch about her theory that Andrew Breitbart, the founder of Breitbart News, was murdered by Vladimir Putin to create a leadership role for Steve Bannon, who would go on to play a key role in President Trump's administration. Breitbart died in 2012 of a heart attack. Here's some of that interview.
What's the evidence?
I said I believe it. I didn't say
You may believe there are fairies at the bottom of your garden. It doesn't make it true.
I may indeed. And if I say so, then that's my belief. If I say this is, I am reporting, as I did with the FISA warrant, that a FISA warrant exists, you may rest assured that I have a basis in fact for a report. A belief is just a belief.
The FISA warrant Mensch mentioned is related to the one legitimate scoop she did have, in which she reported before anyone else that the FBI had been granted a warrant to watch email traffic between the Trump Organization and two Russian banks. McKay Coppins, are there fairies in the bottom of your garden?
Well, I can say that if I believed it, I wouldn't share it unless I had some reason, some evidence to pass along.
Right. If you have your phone on you, please take a picture so at least you can post it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's what journalism is. This is what's so frustrating for a lot of us who are in the business of journalism and reporting facts and investigation and explanation is that, you know, we stake our careers on the stories that we publish, and we go to tremendous lengths to try to get them right. Now, look, the mainstream news industry is not perfect, absolutely, and we've made a lot of mistakes. And I think that in this kind of frenzied era in the Trump presidency, there's been a lot of competition among major news organizations to try to get scoops, and sometimes that's led to sloppiness. But overall, we trade in facts and in what the closest we can get to reality and truth. And that's not necessarily true of a lot of the people in this kind of alternative liberal ecosystem like you just showed. Louise Mensch, what she cares about is passing along things she thinks or her musings, and that's not the same thing as fact, and that's an important distinction to make.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about liberal America's alternative media landscape. You can join the conversation. Do you worry about the rise of alternative media outlets? How do you verify the news you do consume? McKay Coppins, writer for The Atlantic, will be back later in the program. I'd like to introduce John Schindler, who joins us from Sarasota, Florida. He's a national security columnist for The Observer and a former NSA analyst. He frequently tweets about what he calls hashtag Kremlingate to his audience of 245,000 followers. John, thanks for being with us today.
It's great to be here, Ray. Thanks.
And I guess if you've got 245,000 followers and they pass things along as well, that's a potential audience of millions of people.
Yeah, I mean, President Trump has sort of said that his entire legitimacy now is based on his huge numbers of social media followers. Whether you buy that or not, I think we're in a sort of a different media age, that's for sure.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that different media age. How are you different and how are you the same as a news reporter working for a conventional legacy news media organization?
Well, I think one way I'm different is that I am a bit of a gadfly. I like to put ideas out there for discussion. The most important way I'm different is that I'm a veteran of the intelligence business, including working in operational counterintelligence against the Russians, unlike any member of the media I know. So I actually have been in this world, and I still have good contacts in that world, and I have a sort of a built-in ability to vet stories and theories and sometimes wild ideas that most journalists don't have. And that's certainly an advantage in the, as you and McKay were talking about, this very confused media environment with a lot of rumor, a lot of speculation, and not always a lot of facts.
Can you, in good conscience and with a clear head, pass along rumor and speculation that interests you and not have to worry as much about whether it pans out?
Well, I wouldn't quite put it that way. Obviously, not being a byline journalist in the New York Times and Washington Post, I have a certain flexibility they don't have. I also don't have a big house behind me that worries about getting sued. What I tend to do is put hints out for things that are going to come out later. Because of my time in the intelligence business, I know things that are relevant to the investigation and Russian espionage operations, which I frankly can't discuss. I signed a lifetime non-disclosure agreement. But I can see patterns, and I hint at things that are going to eventually be coming out. And that's my sort of main modus operandi, frankly. And I think my longtime followers have picked up on that, that I'll go as far as I can while staying with inside the law. I also have zero interest in compromising intelligence sources and methods, which are of vital importance to Bob Mueller's investigation of Kremlin Gate or whatever we want to call it. So I stay within the lines as a former intelligence officer, but I drop hints wherever I can about what I think the next developments are going to be.
Do you feel duty-bound? Do you feel an obligation to circle back around when something doesn't pan out, when something that's been passed along in your well-read pieces turn out maybe not to be everything that you thought it was in the first place?
I have done that on occasion, although this is going to sound incredibly pompous. It very seldom happens, especially when talking about the whole Trump and the Russians issue, which I've been following a very long time, and have tried to stick to what I'm comfortable saying in public and what I know to be true.
Do you occupy a place in the information ecosystem that's really necessary in 2017, perhaps giving us hints and peaks and glimpses of stories that may end up being on the front page a month from now, and maybe a sort of place that didn't exist not all that long ago?
Well, perhaps, Bray. I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, a lot of things in our media and information space and entertainment space didn't exist 5, 10, 15 years ago simply due to technology. And who knows what it'll look like 5 or 10 or 15 years from now. This space has been created by social media, and I'm in it, and so are a lot of other people. You know, is that helpful? I think it is to some extent. I'm able to be a bit of a reality check as a veteran of the spy war with the Russians on some of the more extreme stuff that's being thrown around out there. And a fair amount of my tweets are slapping down people who are either have no idea what they're talking about or in some cases even have suspect motives.
In preparation for this program, I think it's only fair to point out that a lot of places just wouldn't play. They didn't want to be numbered in among the kind of organizations that we're talking about this hour. You did agree to come on and play, but at the same time, is it, I don't know, even slightly insulting for us to talk about you in the same breath as Left Scoop or Right Wing Watch or the Palmer Report et al.?
Well, I'm not any of those. I simply have no ideological agenda whatsoever. I'm not interested in partisan politics for its own sake, unlike the vast majority of commentators out there. I'm interested in national security. I'm not going to say that I'm above that. I'm human. I have opinions. But when it comes to matters of counterintelligence and intelligence and espionage and security, these are not, no professional views these through an ideological lens. Hacks view them through an ideological lens.
We'll go first to Dayton, Ohio, where Madison is waiting. Hi, Madison. Welcome.
Hi, Ray.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. Well, it's like the alt-left right now is, it's like self-imploding because there's videos of people like on the street like beating up like Trump supporters that probably didn't really do anything. And they always end up being really hypocritical, and it just becomes this mess of that they almost don't even know what they're fighting for, because at the end of the day, they're more focused on what they are rather than who they are, and to just be a decent human being. And it's just something that's always really bothered me.
You know, Madison, I'm glad that you brought up something like demonstrators being beaten up or people on the street being beaten up, because I've seen the same video posted by what places that would consider themselves right-wing, patriot movement-oriented sites and left-wing resistance-oriented sites, they post the same video with completely different motivations because they're trying to tell you diametrically opposed things because they look at that event on one street in one place in America in such different ways.
Of course. It's kind of terrible. It's like, you know, it's like both sides of the spectrum, the political spectrum, it's just terrible. It's almost frightening because you realize that these are real people who are doing this. And, you know, like you mentioned, it's almost the same thing on the left side where they post these videos. Like, you have people who are like, oh, true liberals wouldn't do this. And then you have other people who are like, oh, we gotta fight for what we believe in. It's so important, you know?
Yet I'm willing to bet that so far today in Dayton, you haven't seen anybody beating up anybody on the street, just as when I walked just a little over a mile to work this morning in Boston, I didn't see anybody beating anybody up either. Somebody beeped at somebody because they didn't move quickly enough at a green light. But this is not a country where that's seething in constant street fighting and conflict. But
right.
Boy, some of those signs, some of those sites would have you thinking that.
And that's something I think we really need to highlight on, which is the social media environment we're in unavoidably takes small, very local incidents that would maybe be a feature in the local newspaper or a local news broadcast and treats it like it's something of national significance. And all this does is make everyone get hot and bothered. And I think the antidote to this is, because we're not changing the technology, is we now all need to step back from the intense polarization here. And if you think the crazies and the extremists and the violent people are only on the other side, you're part of the problem.
Our next caller comes from Johnson City, Tennessee. Sarah, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Ray.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I mean, I agree with the previous caller as far as this being frightening and toxic, where you have not only the alt-right, but now an alt-left developing. And I am someone that, you know, I've watched all the news shows, and they are completely different when you see the same, you know, factual, like you were talking about, the same video, but there's two different complete sides to it. I think my question is, what is the credible news source? Or where is it at? I think the truth needs to set us all free. And I would just, you know, I'm turning to, you know, newspaper now, the ones that have been around forever, to try to find what is real, because there's so much fake out there and so much being spun, you know, for one side or the other. And I just want to know what's really going on and where can I find the most credible news sources, or what are the credible news sources? Is there a list? Is there a list of, you know, the alternative fact, you know, media world, and ones not to go to, ones not to. So I guess that's my question, is where is the truth? Where can we find it?
Sarah, getting really retro and reading newspapers again. That's alt right there, Sarah. Thanks a lot for your call. But I think she gets at something, John Schindler, that's very serious. Is there going to be, over time, like a Ouija board with 325 million hands on it, a flight to quality, where we, over time, figure out who's telling us the truth and who's not?
Yeah, and I think that's already starting to happen. And I think we're seeing a movement towards refining some of this, just the beginnings of trying to go from the fire hose of opinion to little more like straws, maybe. That said, I understand the confusion of average people who obviously don't know a lot about these topics and want the truth with a capital T. You know, I think it's possible to get closer to there if you're judicious and you read carefully and understand what people's agendas are. There is always going to be media bias. That is just reality. We all have biases. What we need to get away from is creating narratives which are not about facts. They're about political agendas of all stripes. This is left, right, all over the map. And once you learn to detect those, it becomes very easy to filter out people who are passing on news items or creating news items for a political agenda rather than simply in the public interest.
John Schindler, thanks for being with us today.
It's My pleasure, Ray. Thank you.
You can read John Schindler online, where he is an active communicator. With me again from Washington, McKay Coppins, staff writer for The Atlantic. His recent piece is How the Left Lost Its Mind. It details the alternative left media landscape. And joining me now from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Brendan Nyhan. He's a professor of government at Dartmouth College who studies the spread of false political beliefs. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Ray. Good to be with you.
What do you make of what you just heard from John Schindler?
Well, it is a different world out there. He's part of it. There's been a kind of void that people like him have filled online. One of the things that happens in an environment like this is that people are looking for simple answers or kind of this secret knowledge that people who are involved in promoting conspiracy theories often claim to have. Now, Schindler has some real expertise. I mean, he is unlike some of the more extreme conspiracy theorists in having this background at the National Security Agency, I believe you said. But at the same time, this kind of ongoing set of speculations that's often happening where people are weaving together narratives out of limited or unconfirmed evidence, I think can lead us to a bad place. So I don't want to focus on him, but I do think the larger problem that McKay identifies is an important and concerning one.
Is there, McKay Coppins, a very much almost physics-like part of this story where as the mainstream legacy media loses credibility, loses power, it gives it away in almost Newtonian way to this new world.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, there's no question that the news industry has been especially a part of the broader crisis of authority that American institutions have suffered over the last 20 years or so. Trust in all kinds of once venerated institutions has plummeted. And there's good reason for that, and there are bad reasons for that in the news industry. One of the big reasons is that local newspapers and regional newspapers have all but collapsed or on the verge of collapse throughout the country. And that means increasingly readers feel distant from the kind of national news that they're consuming. They feel like a lot of the news that they're taking in is produced by journalists who live in or are clustered in a couple coastal cities, New York and D.C. and maybe L.A. or San Francisco, who don't understand their communities. And when that loss of trust happens, it makes it that much easier for the media landscape to fracture. I mean, Walter Cronkite used to have 20 million viewers every night when he did his newscast. Now the highest nightly newscasts get 6 or 7 million. And that says something about, you know, how our audience is fracturing. And it means that these blogs that I've talked about, and it happens on the right as well, certainly. I mean, it's happened much to a much larger degree, I think, on the right. But these blogs are able to build niche audiences where they have a lot of authority and are more trusted than, you know, the nightly newscasts and the big national newspapers. And it makes it so that this misinformation is able to spread more easily because, these new niche news outlets, a lot of them don't care about or don't understand kind of journalism standards that a lot of the rest of us adhere to.
We're getting a lot of feedback this hour, as you might imagine. John writes, please stop stooping to their level. Don't give in to conspiracies that cause people to shoot up pizzerias. Trixie writes, it's like old people are trying to get themselves trolled into oblivion forever. Hammerman writes, I don't know what this show is about. I'm solidly left of center on social stuff, solidly center on foreign policy, and I read new left stuff that's been fake. I have to read the story to see what you're talking about. Extreme lies and poisonous propaganda are now mainstream right, not alt, friends to presidents. Whereas to find the same thing on the left, you have to do some work and turn over a lot of damp rocks. And Matt writes, the last thing we need is this clickbait garbage giving the alt-right an excuse for their clickbait garbage. You want to do something constructive? Support real journalists. New York Times, Washington Post, hell, even the Wall Street Journal has done good work. Subscribe and do your duty as citizens. And Hello Kitty adds, the left has not lost its mind. It's just tired of being used and then patted on the head by corporatist neoliberals who call themselves Democrats. We're discussing false information in the liberal alternative media world this hour. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're discussing the growing infrastructure of liberal alternative media. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the partisan divide in alternative media? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Or you can follow me, and I've even got one of those little blue checks next to my name on Twitter, at Ray Suarez News. My guests today are McKay Coppins, staff writer for The Atlantic. You can read his latest piece, How the Left Lost Its Mind, at our website, onpointradio.org. Also with us is Brendan Nyhan, a professor of government at Dartmouth College who studies the spread of false political beliefs. And Bloomington, Illinois is up next. Aaron is calling. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
How you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing awesome. I'm taken back by calling it the alt-left because, you know, it's a bunch of liberals that care about things and people when compared to the alt-right, which is also another, like, ridiculous way to call them something when they're Nazis. They're straight-up Nazis. They wear swastikas. They do the Sieg Heil salute. You know, they're genuine Nazis. And to compare the left to that, calling it the alt-left, that's ridiculous. I mean, I got punched in the face at a Trump rally. These people were, like, yelling the most racist things, talking about how they were going to exterminate people. That just is nonsense. The left hasn't lost their mind. They're reacting to actual fascism.
Well, Aaron, let me ask you something. Is the fact that the other side is bad in any kind of dispute, in any kind of encounter, does that give leave for your side to post things that aren't the truth?
It depends on where you're getting that news. Like, to call the Occupy Democrats, which they're ridiculous. It's like a bunch of, like, crybaby, Hillary supporters mostly, that you know, like, they get in fights with the Bernie Sanders people constantly. I don't know what you would call them, but alt-left or comparing it to the alt-right Nazis is a little ridiculous. I mean, spreading fake news, you know, genuine fake, not true, not fact-based journalism is, you know, well, it's just not journalism. It's just what it is. It's not journalism. Like, you know, you've said it. Everybody else has said it. Like, real journalism is like the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, you know, Sun Times. Like, sure, they all get stories wrong. But, you know, they've got people that get paid to fact check stuff. And it's Facebook. It's freaking Facebook. People troll each other on that thing. Like, it's just social media. Like, to look at that as any source of actual news is just ridiculous, and you're stupid for doing it in the first place.
Aaron, thanks a lot for your call. Brendan Nyhan, is the fact that almost anything that's communicated from one person to another now is called media, as if it's all the same.
That is one of the worries, that we're giving people information in a form that makes it hard for them to distinguish credible from non-credible sources of information. Those cues are very limited online, right? So in the physical world, you can pick up a copy of a newspaper, and the fact that it's printed and distributed in that form is itself a kind of signal of credibility. You're more likely to be familiar with it because it's geographically based, so you know if this is a well-known and well-regarded publication. Online, there are so many news outlets that almost none of us can keep track of all of them, and some of them may be quite legitimate, just something you're not familiar with. So I think in some ways we're really doing a disservice to news readers, and we have to do a better job of promoting news literacy and helping people make those better decisions, especially on the platforms. The caller mentioned Facebook. Facebook is, you know, the maybe the most important way that people get political information now. And unfortunately, it was exploited during the 2016 election to spread largely pro-Trump fake news. Those same weaknesses of the platform can be exploited by all sides, and it's very easy to circulate viral false information. Facebook started to take some initial steps to address that problem, but I think a lot more needs to be done to help people make these better decisions that they're going to need to in this different media landscape.
McKay Coppins, you heard Aaron struggling to make distinctions between the sites he sees and what makes them different to him. I guess it's a mirror held up to the factionalism in American life.
Yeah, and he also got an important point, one that I've heard a lot of people comment on since my article was published, which is that there's actually an interesting divide on the left about this kind of media. So a lot of the discussion about the Democratic Party civil war happening right now is between liberals and leftists. So the leftists, this is very broad generalization, but the leftists would be the Bernie Sanders supporters. Liberals would be people who were closer to Hillary Clinton. And this might surprise some of your listeners, but I found that actually liberals, not leftists, people who are closer to the center, were more likely to be the ones producing the conspiracy theory content and sharing it. And I think there's an obvious ideological reason for that. It's that leftists are pretty invested in the idea that Hillary Clinton lost the election because she was too centrist, because her ideas were too neoliberal, because she pushed back too much against the kind of democratic socialism of Bernie Sanders. So they have their reasons to kind of indict Hillary Clinton's campaign. Liberals want to say that people who are invested in Hillary Clinton's campaign ideologically or otherwise are more likely to say, no, she lost because of the Russian conspiracy or because, votes were tampered with or voting booths were hacked. I found that liberals, kind of center-left people, are more likely, and obviously this is not the case of everyone in the center-left, but there's actually more of a temptation on the center-left right now to engage in the kind of conspiracy theories than there is in the Bernie wing of the party, who are kind of fighting their own crusade to take down neoliberals like Hillary Clinton.
Columbia, Missouri is next. Victoria's on the line. Victoria, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
So I was actually just going to talk a little bit about that divide between the Bernie supporters and Hillary and leftists versus liberals. I'm a college student and I consider myself ideologically like leaning towards socialism and communism. So I joined some groups on Facebook that call themselves together Leftbook. And so these are people who are generally anarcho-communists, against neoliberalism, didn't like Hillary. But I found that even divides among them can get so far left that, they don't want to work within any kind of political system that we have now. They want like anarchy now, overthrowing of the government now, and they don't really realize that change happens gradually.
So when you talk about these divides, does it manifest itself in what these people are posting, passing on, and telling each other?
Oh, yeah. And they're big on blocking people from groups. They're big on just nitpicking at things. Like, you can't say dumb in this group because that's an ableist slur. And it's really, we ought to deal with the fact that Betsy DeVos wants to defund education for disabled students, maybe, instead of dealing with whether we can say stupid on Facebook or if that's ableist. So they form their group, and they're so far over, and they don't want anyone in there who doesn't think the same things as them. And I understand that, but 50% of the country voted for Trump. You know, we can't completely have a far-left socialist community nation, like, tomorrow. And that's what they want.
Victoria, thanks for your call from Columbia, Missouri. We'll go next to York, South Carolina. John is on the line. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hiya, John.
Yes, I've been listening all morning, and I must agree, a lie is a lie, propaganda is propaganda, and fake news is still fake news, no matter which side it comes from. I've endured the last 8 years listening to all kinds of crazy conspiracies concerning President Obama, he's a secret Muslim, yet he's in a photo somewhere eating a bacon cheeseburger. He's a devil incarnate. And now we've got people on the extreme left saying silly things like President Trump's wife, Melania, is a secret Russian agent. She's his handler of Vladimir Putin. I mean, it goes from one crazy extreme to the other. But what I'm truly disappointed about is our leadership. No one will step forward and say, time out, hold it. Let's stop all of this.
You know, John, that's an interesting point. And I'm wondering, Brendan and McKay, whether politics feels risky in a way that that it didn't before, and you're just afraid in a way that well, maybe you were before or maybe you weren't, of offending distinct, discrete groups inside the electorate, so that you won't, as our caller suggests, say, hey, come on now, snap out of it. This stuff is nuts. Stop saying it.
I think that's right, Ray. We've seen a failure to provide a reality-based perspective to the base. As the caller suggested, there were all sorts of conspiracy theories circulating about President Obama during his time in office that many Republican office holders winked and nodded at, if not actively encouraged and promoted. And the question for Democrats now is whether they'll do the same thing with the most extreme Russia conspiracy theories. I don't think that they've been mainstreamed to nearly the same extent. But a real question is whether that process will continue, right? We've seen these sorts of worrisome signs of the kinds of sources you've been discussing during this program being repeated by a U.S. senator, being repeated by a very prominent constitutional law professor, seeing an MSNBC host promoting an elaborate conspiracy theory about Trump, Putin, and the Syria missile strikes on national television. So there's a progression here that can happen. We've seen it happen before, and people should worry about whether it will continue. And it's remarkable to me, again, just to put a point on it, that so many Democrats spent years condemning the sorts of unfounded conspiracy theories we saw during the Obama years. And now that the tables have turned, many of the same people are endorsing or at least tolerating similar kinds of claims and behaviors on their side. It's remarkable how fast that has shifted.
Let me put a little meat on the bones. You referred to the MSNBC report. This is Lawrence O'Donnell. After President Trump ordered the missile strike on Syria, a theory emerged on the Palmer Report, a left-leaning website that publishes some unfounded claims, that said Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered the chemical weapons attack in Syria to help President Trump. The site said the attack would distract Americans from an investigation into Trump's campaign ties to Russia by allowing President Trump to launch the missile strike. That theory went mainstream when Lawrence O'Donnell brought it up on MSNBC and his show, The Last Word, in April.
Wouldn't it be nice if it was just completely, totally, absolutely impossible to suspect that Vladimir Putin orchestrated what happened in Syria this week so that his friend in the White House could have a big night with missiles and all of the praise he's picked up over the last 24 hours?
McKay Coppins, is this the part of the story that maybe doesn't get remarked on enough? The way these sites inject into the public's bloodstream ideas that can't find their way to legitimacy through conventional paths.
Yeah, absolutely. That is the dangerous thing about this alternative liberal universe, because I bet a lot of your listeners are probably liberals. They consider themselves liberals, and they're listening to this and they're saying, well, look, I've never heard of the Palmer Report, or I've never seen Occupy Democrats. I don't know what these sites are, so they can't be that influential. And there's no question that they're not as influential as the right-wing ecosystem is in the Republican Party. But the example you just provided is a great example of how these rumors and speculation and conspiracy theories can bubble up from kind of the bowels of the internet and then all of a sudden get a big billing on national television. Another example I have in my piece at The Atlantic is Democratic Senator Ed Markey from Massachusetts was giving an interview to CNN back in May. And this is a small thing, but during the interview, he said that something that seemed like it was big news. He said a grand jury had been impaneled in New York to investigate the Trump campaign's alleged collusion with Russia. That wasn't true. And once reporters started asking his office for more details, they had to concede that actually this information came from the Palmer Report, that same liberal blog. And you know, look, they apologized, but it was a good example of how these ideas and these stories can start out on kind of somewhat fringe websites that most people haven't heard of, and then very quickly land on the desk of a United States senator who repeats them on CNN. I mean, when that's happening, it's clear that we have to pay attention to this process and to the media universe where this stuff is originating.
Brendan Nyhan, before we go, this is your area of inquiry. Are we in the middle of a syndrome that leads to a shakeout? Or are there a lot more chapters to play in this soap opera and a lot more misinformation to be sent out before we start to rein things in?
Given how polarized we are, the incentives are unfortunately really strong to promote this kind of misinformation. I worry that the sanctions against elites aren't strong enough. You know, what happened with Markey is a encouraging example, but we need more of that. It should harm your reputation to promote this kind of misinformation, and we need to hold elites accountable when they do it.
Brendan Nyhan is a professor of government at Dartmouth College. Thanks so much for your time today.
Good to be with you.
And McKay Coppins was with us, staff writer for The Atlantic. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Ray.
Earlier, we spoke to John Schindler, national security columnist for The Observer. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, or follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio, or follow me at Ray Suarez News. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.